From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a caliphate in Iraq. Hobby Lobby wins at the Supreme Court. Dead teens and tension between Israelis and Palestinians. Strong new U.S. jobs numbers. The High Court ruled that for-profit employers can opt out of providing contraception for religious reasons. Justice Ginsburg warned of a parade of horribles. Hobby Lobby supporters celebrated.
Paving the way for religious freedom and the right to have our own conscience within our private businesses.
In Murrieta, California, protests in the streets against undocumented mothers and children from across the border.
Residents here have been resisting plans to have the migrants brought here for processing and health checks. The bus windows were blocked, but the shouts made it clear to those on board they are not welcome here.
And Hurricane Arthur churns off the East Coast. North Carolina Governor Pat McGrory told people to play it safe.
I want to reiterate, don't put your stupid hat on. Usually most injuries occur right before a storm or right after a storm.
Don't put your stupid hat on. This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Margaret Taleb of Bloomberg News, James Kitfield of National Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Is this caliphate for real? Is the Supreme Court ruling your way? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us for a one-day early holiday weekend, Week in the News Roundtable, Margaret Taleb in Washington, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Margaret Taleb, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
James Kitfield joins us from Washington, contributing editor at National Journal at Defense One, Atlantic Media's online journal of defense and national security. James Kitfield, welcome back to you as well.
Hey, Tom. Good to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Margaret, and James.
Let's go straight to the caliphate. ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or just the Islamic State, as they say they now want to be called, announced Sunday via a web video the establishment of a Muslim caliphate and declared that its leader was Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the current head of ISIS, interpreted here by AFP.
And so the Islamic State has decided with the elders and the emirs and the Shura Council to announce the establishment of an Islamic caliphate.
James Kitfield, words maybe we thought we'd never hear, and there it is. And they've got territory, they've got cities, they've got money, they've got soldiers taking more territory across the border in Syria. Even today, we're told. Is this for real, James?
No, it's very much for real. I mean, these guys, something else they have is a lot of money now. They have the largest oil refinery in Iraq. They have oil areas in Syria. They have the initiative. I mean, they have basically had a juggernaut thanks really to this alliance they made with the Sunni tribes. But they've taken, you know, really all the Sunni areas of Iraq and much of sort of eastern Syria. And so you can't – you have to take them very, very seriously.
I mean, and with that, the White House saying we'll send some more troops, another couple hundred, takes it up to 700 or 800. On Tuesday, Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby talked about those troops, saying the Obama administration was sending to Iraq no mission creep.
There's no mission creep. The missions haven't changed. Some of the numbers have been added in the security assistance realm. And look, it's very fluid. And the commander-in-chief and the military leadership here in the building, I think, expect and should have a certain measure of flexibility, Aaron.
A certain measure of flexibility. The whole world, Iraq certainly, and Americans watching very closely here. Margaret Taleb, what are you hearing out of the White House about what they're seeing in Iraq and how far they're prepared to go in response with more boots on the ground?
You know, you're really not hearing how far they're prepared to go. And it will get to a certain point where the number of military who are there to provide security for embassy personnel or who are there to help figure out whether to, you know, do airstrikes, there will be some magic number at which point you just can't sustain an embassy there anymore and where the number just becomes too large. It's unclear, like, was that number going to be 300? No. Is that number going to be 770? Not quite yet. But as you get closer to 1,000, you really get into numbers that are hard to hard to come out as an official and say it's not mission creep. And I think on the question of a caliphate, you know, is the caliphate real? Are Muslims worldwide going to recognize this gentleman as their new leader? Right. That's not really the question. The question is, what is happening inside Iraq? Can Iraq hold together? The Kurds now making their own moves towards more autonomy. This fight over whether Maliki can hang on or how long he can hang on. It is really heating up, and the White House is trying to have some hand in controlling a situation that's really outside of its control.
The U.S. and many others saying we need a unity government in Iraq, but it wasn't happening this week. There was a televised address on Wednesday. The Iraqi prime minister is saying, hey, we've got too big a threat to mess around with that.
First, they talked about an Islamic State in Iraq and Levant. Today, they talk about a caliphate in the region. Iraq and its neighbors are not safe from their projects. We will not submit, and undoubtedly, they will suffer a severe defeat.
They'll suffer a defeat, but they sure aren't suffering a defeat so far. Jack Beatty, Maliki is saying there, never mind all this talk about unity government. We've got to fight. It's time to fight, not mess around with politics. American leaders saying something rather different, Jack.
Yes, and just last week, Secretary Kerry was in Baghdad and said that Maliki had agreed with him that politics first. We have to have a unity government first. This week, Mr. Maliki says no, fighting first. But of course, the predicate of effective fighting is a government people can believe in. Or to put it even more, in the right terms, a government that even Sunni soldiers can fight for, and that's way in the distance now. It sounds like it's being postponed. And when you hear that the, you know, what could change in the new, in our new government, what could happen, when you hear that Ahmad Chalabi, our old friend from the past, may come back as the, you know, sort of consensus leader of
unbelievable.
Unbelievable. I mean, it just makes the head spin.
Here we are with these hundreds of U.S. forces already in there, James, and presumably they're doing a couple of things. I mean, one report we hear is they're assessing the Iraqi army's capacity to resist the Islamic State, ISIS, whatever you want to call it. Presumably they're assessing how the U.S. might help. Are you hearing anything about what they are seeing? Do they see this army is prepared to defend even Baghdad, James?
Well, this is what's very worrisome about what we've seen in the last couple of days. You know, that we sent these teams in there to assess the capabilities of the Iraq security forces. Very quickly thereafter, we sent not only more troops, but Apache helicopters with American crews. That tells me that they found that the situation with the Iraqi security forces is so bad that they didn't think they could even protect Baghdad and the Baghdad airport. So it's very hard to see how you put Humpty Dumpty back together here. The Iraqi security forces have basically broken down along their Shia sectarian and Sunni sectarian divide. And, absent a political, deal that is not in the offing, apparently, that's not going to happen. So, we're stuck in a situation where we want to supply help to the Iraqi government, but we can't be seen as being the air force for just a Shia army against Sunnis. So until there's a political deal, we can't really be effective. And the political deal has been discussed. The parliament broke up. I was very concerned when I saw that Barzani has said he's going to put independence to a referendum, because once the Kurds...
Sunnis and Kurds walked out when Maliki failed to name a prime minister to replace himself for, and none showed
right.
up.
And then the Kurdish leader said that he's going to hold a referendum for independence. You know, if that happens and they declare their independence, the centrifugal forces pulling Iraq apart are going to be very, very strong.
Let me ask you about the American personnel still in that enormous green zone, biggest American embassy in the world. Do we have enough troops? I mean, I'm keeping my eye on the Baghdad airport. If they're going to get out, don't they have to get out through that airport if it starts being shelled by ISIS? Can they get out? Are we near a time when they may pull the ripcord and really pull bulk out of that green zone?
Well, we've already started to evacuate all but non-essential personnel. So that's another sign of how they're reading the sort of tactical situation. They're pulling them out to Kuwait. They're pulling them into different places in the area. But again, the Apaches, I think, were there to make sure that if you had to fly them out of the airport, you could defend the airport. Those are very powerful weapons, and they're manned by American crews. I think that's the very reason why they're there.
And of course, the concern about this reaching outside of the region as well. Here was a video released by ISIS a couple of weeks ago, but it got a lot of play this week. A Canadian ISIS fighter named Farah Mohammed Shirdan, originally Somali. His father was a high official in Somalia, burning his Canadian passport and threatening President Obama.
After Sham, after Iraq, after Jazeera, we are going for you, Barack Obama. Takbir!
Margaret Taleb, and this week we've seen the United States asking airports abroad to take new, stricter security measures on flights headed to the U.S.
And can you blame them? I mean, President Obama is trying at this point to learn from lessons of the past, not just everything that's happened since 9/11, but everything that's happened since Benghazi when it comes to embassy security, certainly everything that happens domestically with DHS and airports. The U.S. is trying to take the steps that it can domestically to make sure that, you know, they're doing everything that they can. And at the same time, looking at sort of the big global picture, you're seeing this affect our timing and our movements on Syria policy. We're watching separately this parallel situation unfold between the Israelis and the Palestinians. This all takes place in the sort of the opening period of Ramadan. There are a lot of moving parts right now.
Could we still see significant American airstrikes come in here in the middle of this conflict in Iraq, Margaret?
Well, part of the thought with the sending the assessment teams, and James, of course, can speak to this also, is for the U.S. to figure out whether that makes sense and how to do it. And I think certainly we could. But the question is, on this parallel track with what's happening in the Iraqi parliament, does it make sense? Are you helping to stabilize the situation, helping to protect security, or are you being a trigger that spirals things further out of control? And the real question is not whether ISIS takes over the leadership of Iraq. It is whether the entire situation collapses.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Caliphate in Iraq, the Supreme Court and Hobby Lobby, dead teens, Israel and the Palestinians, the president saying to Congress, sue me. Margaret Taleb is with us, Bloomberg News correspondent at the White House. James Kitfield is here from National Journal, Defense One. Jack Beatty is here. We've got a lot to look at abroad and at home. We'll bring it home. But first, still in Iraq, lots of callers here. Iowa City, Iowa, Kasser's calling. Kasser, you're on the air. What do you see?
Yes, sir. I think our foreign policy is has suffered tremendously due to the undue influence of the Saudi royal family, the Israeli lobby, and the American Jewish lobby.
How so? What's the problem, Kasser? Why? What's the problem?
The problem is that they have done everything to keep Iran away. The U.S. should have taken Iran into confidence when we went into Iraq. Today, I think we are on our knees. Iran knew that ISIS was going to take over. Iran sat and waited till we are on our knees, and now Iran will dictate the terms. We declared them terrorists. Today, we need them, and in actuality...
Kasser, we've got it. You're breaking up a little bit, but Iran will dictate the terms. Let us hold that thought and get one more right here, if I may. Michael in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Great show as always, Tom. The way I see it and the way everybody sees it on the ground, in my opinion, is Saudi Arabia now has 30,000 troops on the border of Iraq, and they're basically going to be a proxy war in Iraq between Iran and the Saudi-Sunni alliance. And what's going to happen, the Kurds are going to separate immediately, declare independence, and Maliki is just going to have a rump of a government of South Baghdad and Basra. And the rest is all going to go to what we're calling the caliphate now. But the ISIS is basically being supported by Saudi Arabia, which is our ally. And it seems to me that I don't think the White House really knows what our policy is supposed to be. One of your commenters said that the president is trying to learn from past mistakes. This isn't a classroom in the White House where you talk about stuff and try to learn from mistakes. You have to take decisive actions.
Well, point taken, Michael. We've got it. The whole world is a very deadly classroom sometimes. James Kitfield, what about this notion of a proxy war? Our first caller saying, you know, Iran ready to pick up the pieces and dictate terms now. Second caller seeing a potential proxy war across this region, Saudi v. Iran. What about it?
That war started 3 years ago with Syria, and this is just that war spreading. So the Saudis and Iran have been in a proxy war in Syria and that civil war for a couple of, you know, more than 2.5 years now. It is spreading. But, you know, to show you how convoluted this is, I mean, the Saudis are very close to a lot of the Sunni tribes in Iraq. That's true. They're through intermarriage and relations.
But is that the same as close to ISIS?
No, it's not. They are very concerned about ISIS. If you'll remember, the Saudis, you know, had a huge al-Qaeda campaign against Saudi Arabia a few years back, and they put that down mercilessly. And ever since then, they've been very, very wary of these al-Qaeda-linked groups. This was the original al-Qaeda in Iraq. It's now calling itself ISIS. So the Saudis are torn, too, because of this conflict. But they hate Maliki. They hate that government in Baghdad. So it's a very, very convoluted situation. But there's been a proxy war going on, and the problem is the Iranians have been willing to back their proxy in Syria and now in Iraq to a much higher degree than we're willing to back our proxy.
We'll see how far Saudi Arabia steps up, though. You don't know what to hope for here. If it goes proxy, you don't know where this ends. Margaret, you mentioned all the tensions in Israel and with the Palestinians in the last week. Let's bring that in here. We want to bring it home, but there's so much going on. Of course, three Israeli teenagers kidnapped, found dead. Since then, we've had Palestinians taken off the street and death on that side as well. On Tuesday, Ron Dermer, the Israeli ambassador to the U.S., blamed Hamas for the death of those three Israeli teenagers here on CNN.
Members of Hamas perpetrated this crime, the kidnapping and execution of three teenage boys. It's important for Israel to send a message to Hamas that this is completely unacceptable and we won't tolerate it.
Hanan Ashrawi, an executive committee member for the Palestinian Liberation Organization, PLO, talked to CNN from Ramallah, Palestine.
Israel cannot just start accusing everybody without any evidence. And it has decided that it's going to punish everybody. And it has decided that Hamas is guilty, even though Hamas denies any involvement.
We've got tragedy on all sides here and some pretty ugly things unrolling, Margaret. How does this factor into the bigger regional issue? And what about on its own terms?
Right. And can you remember that it wasn't that long ago when Obama and Netanyahu were making jokes about red lines on the tarmac, in Tel Aviv and wearing matching ties and actively.
I'm not sure what you mean by that. How does that factor in here?
The situation is so degraded all of a sudden in the last few months from a time when John Kerry and President Obama
talking about a
peace deal. You know, the White House is in this precarious position that it often finds itself in when there are conflicts between the Israelis and the Palestinians, of on the one hand saying Israel has the right to defend itself for security reasons, and then on the other hand, very strongly from the podium yesterday, the White House press secretary coming out and condemning the most recent death of the Arab teenager, everyone in the U.S. publicly calling on Israel to be very careful as it proceeds, not to inflame the situation even as they exert their own rights. So this is, again, a situation that the U.S. has very little control over, that threatens on its own terms to really complicate the Israeli-Palestinian process and to spill into broader problems for the region.
Raj in Madison, Wisconsin. Raj, you're on the air.
Well, hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a Palestinian-American who came as an immigrant in 1952, but I've gone back to the Arab world regularly.
Mm-hmm.
The post-colonial generation has invested enormously in education in the Arab world. Generation after generation, they have become better educated, more in touch with the rest of the world. In my judgment, the millennial generation, which includes my grandnephews and grandnieces, in the Arab world, is not about to put up with anybody who is going to tell them how to live. And they will eventually get over the Saudis, and this caliphate is just a sham. If they have 20, 30,000 people, they're going to try to control 80 or 90 million people in the Arab world. No, actually, it's more than that, because it's not now.
You're saying it won't happen. What about in Israel and in the West Bank right now? I mean, kids being snatched off the streets and turning up dead now on both sides here. Where does that actually take us from?
It is my view that the issue between Palestinians and Israelis will continue inflamed until the generation of Israelis who were very much in touch with the Holocaust have passed on. The younger generation that is not as poisoned about Gentiles, and they recognize that the Jewish population, the Sephardic community coexisted with Islamic Arabs, Christian Arabs for many, many centuries under the Ottoman Empire.
Raj, let us pick it up right there, and I appreciate your call, Jack Beatty. Do we have to wait for the Holocaust legacy, which, you know, many are determined to make eternal, the memory of it? I mean, there are museums now, plenty of them, just to do that. You have to wait for that to pass before we can find some way out here, Jack?
Well, it's interesting. Martin Indyk, the former top U.S. envoy to the Middle East, just retired just this week, was really voicing a pessimism at the opposite, a view at the opposite pole from Raj's. He says, looking at these events, these reprisal, first the killing, then the reprisal killing, he said, essentially what you've got now is a more rapidly deteriorating situation in which all of the worst fears and assumptions about the other side are being confirmed. He remembers watching with tears of hope, this is Martin Indyk, the September 1993 handshake between Rabin and Arafat on the South Lawn of the White House. He said, but it's been 20 years, and so many people have died, and so many hopes have been dashed on both sides, that there is deep skepticism in the heart of the people, Israelis and Palestinians. People on both sides do not believe that peace is possible. That's our former, just stepped down, envoy to the Middle East.
One more call, and we've got to bring it home. There's so much in the USA. Shira in Newton, Massachusetts, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I just wanted to respond to the person who just called, linking the Holocaust with all this business in the Middle East. I just don't know where to start. I mean, there's absolutely no link between the Holocaust and what's going on now in Israel. I mean, these three children were kidnapped, abducted, and murdered. The hate that's filling the Arab population in Israel is what's causing all this, and it's coming totally from the Arab side. The Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, by the way, are all feeding these people hate upon hate.
Well, Shira, we do now have a dead Palestinian teen as well, apparently murdered. That's not exactly loving.
We do not know who killed him. There is a speculation that this was an internal thing, that it had nothing to do with Israelis.
There's much more speculation, I must say, just objectively, that it was reprisal. I mean, there are both, of course, but
objectively by whom, first of all? I mean, people are very quick to blame Israel for things that it doesn't even do. For instance, that kid who was shot in Gaza, that the whole world was crying out about him, it turned out to have been an Arab bullet. It was not an Israeli bullet.
Shira, may I ask you, can you see the ISIS, Islamic State, all the turmoil there, linking up with this turmoil in Israel and the West Bank, blowing across Jordan, and this becoming one big mess?
Well, it's one big mess already. I mean, the hate that is perpetrated in the Arab countries against Jews and Israel is absolutely astounding. And what do they think is going to happen when they feed people all this? I mean, it's just, it's a cause and effect thing.
Sure, I appreciate your call. Too much hate, no question about it. We've got to bring it home. The Hobby Lobby decision by the Supreme Court, a very big decision here. Corporate religious rights for closely held corporations where the people involved have strong religious views, Justice Alito said. Hobby Lobby was at the heart of it. Co-founders David and Barbara Green responded in a video after the Supreme Court's judgment. Barbara Green spoke for the couple, thanking the company's employers and customers and supporters.
The Supreme Court reaffirmed what our family has always believed, that America is a country founded on and sustained by religious liberty. It's been a long journey, but an important one for our family and for those who wish to be guided in all areas of life, including their businesses, by faith and conscience.
They were celebrating. Many others were not. Among them, Hillary Clinton said in a Facebook Live interview at the Aspen Ideas Festival that she disagreed with both the court's reasoning and the decision.
It's the first time that our court has said that a closely held corporation has the rights of a person when it comes to religious freedom, which means that the corporation's employers can impose their religious beliefs on their employees, and of course, denying women the right to contraception as part of their health care plan is exactly that. I find it deeply disturbing.
Margaret Tolliver, Justice Alito said this is a narrow decision, this is not broad and sweeping. Justice Ginsburg in dissent warned of a parade of horribles coming. This is a first step. We'll see a lot more. What have we just witnessed here in the Supreme Court decision, Margaret?
Well, it probably won't be as narrow as the idea that it is the most narrowest of rulings, because when the Supreme Court even decides to take a case, they understand that it may have broad-reaching implications, unintended or unforeseen implications. So it is really a major question, is how broadly will this apply beyond just this issue of Obamacare coverage? Will it apply to women's issues more broadly, to gay issues more broadly? And you're also seeing
businesses who might object to gay marriage or gay lifestyle somehow imposing some religious belief on their employees.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we've already seen the sort of the evolution of corporations and giving in terms of campaign finance. And I think this may be sort of a parallel to that. We're also seeing a gelling of the Supreme Court, kind of with Roberts really settling into his role as Chief Justice and sort of occasionally siding with the liberals, but often being the important swing vote in the other direction, kind of the counterpoint of Roberts' role versus Alito's role. I think on many levels, both in American politics and in the evolutions of corporate powers, this could be a really important case down the road.
Lots of women up in arms, though. We heard them celebrating there at the court as well, women. Joe in Buffalo, New York. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi. You know, I just think that this decision illustrates that we got to take the health care decisions out of the hands of the employers entirely. People should be buying their health insurance directly. It should be freed from your employer. The health care exchanges seem to be a good step in this direction, and I think this just, further strengthens the argument that that's the way to go.
No intermediary, please. That would take anybody's religious views out of it, at least in that relationship. Jack, what do you think we've just seen here? Is some great new door cracked open here? If so, toward what?
Well, on the narrow question of Obamacare and the provision of contraception, Justice Alito says that the government's accommodation that it had worked out with nonprofit organizations about a year ago, its accommodation was basically, okay, you don't want, for religious reasons, to cover contraception for your employees.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we will require the insurance company to simply provide it to the employees.
And they'll just eat the expense of it because it's cheaper for them than a pregnancy.
Exactly. And Justice Alito said that that accommodation, quote, achieves all the government's aims while providing greater respect for religious liberty. Now, that suggests that the Little Sisters of the Poor is another group that's going to come with a case to the court, that the court is not going to be receptive to that argument that, there is nothing, in other words, the court will say, look, there's an accommodation here. We sanctioned it. We agreed with it in the Hobby Lobby case. We can't very well turn around against it now. And people actually think that in that sense will mean that Obamacare's envisioned end, which is the provision of contraceptive devices and contraceptives generally, will go forward. But on the broader question, this is the issue that Justice Ginsburg raised. She says it's a minefield, and she looks at the broad question of extending, religious right to the corporate person. She wonders, will that mean that you can have religiously grounded objections to blood transfusions, Jehovah's Witnesses, antidepressants, Scientologists, medications derived from pigs, Muslims. She goes on and on and on. Is this the can of worms that the court has opened up? And we just don't know that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, the U.S. lost to Belgium at the World Cup. 2-1, all done. But not before U.S. goalie Tim Howard made an epic number of saves, 16.
Come back, Fellaini. Now Hazard! Again, Tim Howard!
On Monday, President Obama and First Lady Michelle said goodbye to White House pastry chef Bill Yozy and his delicious pies. It got a little gnarly.
His pies, I don't know what he does, whether he puts crack in them or... but...
No, he doesn't. There is no crack in our pies.
at an LGBT event there at the White House, Michelle Obama not going for crack pies, and Fancy by Australian Iggy Azalea topped U.S. charts for the sixth week. Is this the summer song of 2014?
I'll be the I-G-G-Y, put my name in ball. I've been working, I'm up in here with some change to throw.
I'm so fancy. You already.
We're looking at a week in the news. Caliphate in Iraq, the Supreme Court, and Hobby Lobby, the President to Congress. Sue me. Margaret Tolliv is with us. White House correspondent for Bloomberg News, James Kitfield from National Journal, Defense One. Jack Beatty is here. Immigration, big this week. All those kids and moms showing up at the border, coming across on Sunday on CBS's Face the Nation. Congressman Michael McCaul, Republican from Texas, said a message of deterrence is necessary to stop the flow of immigrants coming to the U.S.
It's a crisis like nothing I've ever seen before at the border. We have refugee camps now in my and your home state of Texas. It's a very serious concern. I don't think the flow will stop until a message of deterrence is sent back to Central America. The drug traffickers are making $5,000 a child on these children, advertising that if you get into the United States, you can stay.
Is it because of all the violence in Central America? There is a lot. We've reported it right here on this show. Is it because the message has gone out somehow, come to the U.S., you'll be fine? Same time, immigration progress on legislative reform kind of shutting down in Washington. On Monday, President Obama said he would act alone as far as he could if necessary.
I'm beginning a new effort to fix as much of our immigration system as I can on my own, without Congress.
And on a broader agenda as well, John Boehner said last week he might sue the president for overreach, executive overreach. President kind of saying, well, if you're not going to do anything, bring it on.
Middle class families can't wait for Republicans in Congress to do stuff. So sue me. I, as long as they're doing nothing, I'm not going to apologize for trying to do something.
Sue me. Haven't heard that before. Margaret Tallow, let's go to the immigration issue here. Amazing scenes this week out of that little town in California where mothers and children who had come across undocumented up from Central America, flown out to California. They're having a heck of a time processing and dealing with this crush of people and kids at the border. And townspeople showed up, blocked the buses from coming into the processing center, turned them around. Mm-hmm. Are we at some kind of inflection point in American immigration public attitudes, public policy this week, Margaret?
Well, I want to say yes, but it was Arizona, you know, the year or two before. And even when Barack Obama was a U.S. senator for that brief flash in U.S. Mm-hmm. history, this was, you know, at the cusp of being resolved and then wasn't resolved. This is a longer term problem. And there are, you know, flashpoints and turning points. Right now, what has got the U.S. administration really in knots is this story about the children, this trend of children coming across the border without their parents. And I think what we're seeing with President Obama acting this week has only a little bit to do with the fact that John Boehner told him at a golf event that it was done. I mean, the White House already knew that the Republicans were not going to do anything this summer on immigration in terms of a vote. But the White House feels that they must respond to this issue of unaccompanied
But how much can the president really do on his own here? I mean, immigration reform, that is vast. That reaches into all kinds of areas. He's saying he's going to try and tackle what he can. What can he do alone?
Well, I mean, it is actually kind of true that what he can do is move assets around and closer to the border. It doesn't solve certainly the entire problem. It does solve, in theory, a problem of picking up children and either putting them in a safe place or returning them to where they came from. But there is not very much he can do if what you're asking is, what are you going to do with 11 million people? I mean, that's something that requires Congress, Congress to act, and Congress is not going to act right now.
Everybody in. Brad in Franklin, Tennessee. Brad, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, okay. What do you see, Brad?
A lot of people have opinions about this immigration issue, and it's gotten kind of out of control, people attacking each other. I have an opinion, but that doesn't mean I'm right. I'm not an expert. I don't know who is. But
yeah.
The one point I think that most people are missing is, if there is a law on the books related to immigration, whether you like it or not, you follow the law. If the law is wrong, you change the law. But until that point, the law is a law. Congress makes the laws. et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, Brad, I hear you. Let me ask you a question. What if the law, for practical reasons, needs changing somehow, but we can't get it together to do that?
Well, that would be a problem with the Congress. You know, it's all this infighting. It's like a Friday night football game. I don't know you, but I hate you. Well, no, that's not what it's about. This is about America. And if the people in Congress or the president can't get the job done, they work for us.
Yeah,
we need to all quit complaining and do something about it.
Yeah, Brad, I so appreciate your call. Let's get this into process and deal with things here. But the law is the law. James Kitfield, pick up this issue, which is debated this week, about what's really pushing this new wave of children to the U.S. border and more. You're hearing both that, you know, you got the murder capital of the world in Honduras and terrible circumstances in Guatemala and more in Central America and Mexico on the one hand. On the other hand, the Republican and more argument is that a message has gone out that somehow come and it's going to be fine. You can stay. The White House trying to turn that message around this week, but it's tough to turn around. Where do you see the bigger impetus for this influx, James?
I think it's a combination of both. I mean, we definitely, you know, the drug cartels in Mexico have taken over all of those smuggling routes. We've pushed that problem into Central America, which has created this huge gang problem, and it's all to do with the sort of all these countries are way stations along the drug line from Colombia to America. At the same time, I mean, the message that went out when the president tried to do something unilaterally, which was adopt a policy of not deporting children who were brought here, you know, through no fault of their own, you know, that message has been skewed by the human traffickers to say, you know, if kids won't be expelled. So you've got a huge problem here. And, you know, this is what happens, you know, my takeaway from this is what happens when Washington is dysfunctional. We've known we've had an immigration problem for years now, and you know the two sides cannot come together. And if you don't fix problems, you allow them to fester and stew and get worse and worse. You get a really shameful situation like we saw where those people were hammered on the side of a bus full of women and children, which I found as an American quite disturbing.
Boy, JT in Bowling Green, Kentucky. JT, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
What do you think?
I just want to say, start by saying I'm aggravated. I'm aggravated with our current administration. I'm aggravated with the tyrant of a president we have, and I'm aggravated with the American people. I'm sorry that these are our kids and women, but we have our own problems. Our economy is not in any position to be letting people just come in willy-nilly. And, you know, there is a legal way to come to this country and become a citizen. If you want to be here, you should do it the right way. You should be proud enough of this place that you want to be here to do it the right way. And on the president saying, sue me, just want to make a foretelling comment. Next year when the Republicans do have the Senate back, they may very well sue you, and we may say goodbye to the tyrant.
May just do it. JT, I appreciate your call. I mean, I know what you mean. On the other hand, I don't know about your people, but mine came very, very poor here, needing a job, and I'm glad they were let in and not backed off the boat. Michael in St. Paul, Minnesota. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, sir. Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm okay. What do you see? What do you think?
Yeah, why don't people see the positive thing that could happen here? I mean, here's millions of people. Our Social Security system is failing, and it's failing because of the lack of people paying into it. If we legalize all these people, that's gonna buffer up our whole economy. These people need clothing. They're going to be buying cars. They're going to be everything that we buy in America is going to buffer us up.
You say bring them on, but what about the jobs question? I know we had a great report today, 280,000 plus, but you heard JT saying we don't have enough jobs.
Well, yeah, but there will be jobs created when these people start buying things.
Yeah, Michael, we got it in Minnesota. And one more from Ames, Iowa. Steve, you're on.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Okay. What do you see?
Just with the whole comment about the president saying so sue me against Congress, I think it speaks to a larger issue of essentially that gerrymandering and redistricting has essentially made Congress and congressional districts almost non-competitive from the other parties. So everybody just gets more and more extreme, leading to this gridlock, leading to this attitude of, you know, I just have to oppose whatever the other party's doing and I'll be reelected. So I think that whole problem is creating this culture, and I think until it's solved, we're going to just keep seeing Congress do issues like this over and over again.
Steve, I appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, we have callers calling in saying they're aggravated on many fronts. And you can hear there's different facets to that, some of them opposing themselves, but that aggravation with Washington not dealing with a changing world, Jack.
Yes, and it's fueling a perception of a failed president. You know, it must really, get the president. That Quinnipiac had a poll this week showing that a substantial number of Americans, or more Americans than any other president, think he's the worst president since the post-war, since World War II. And, you know, he looks at Congress, he looks at the House. They're effectively on strike. It is by far the least active Congress in history. It beats the 1946 Congress by galactic distances. On the other hand, it isn't just the Republican House, his own Senate, his Democratic Senate. This week, reporting came out that Harry Reid has blocked Republican amendments more than twice the number of times used by the previous six majority leaders combined. In other words, the Republicans are on strike in the Senate because they feel they can't get their amendments answered, and there seems to be acted on, and there seems to be some reason for that. So the president is genuinely angry, but of all weeks to talk about, you know, I'm these Republicans and so on, and the Washington Post is out today talking about the president's contempt for the Republicans. Of all the weeks to be raising that, he needs Congress's approval to have the Border Patrol turn back these immigrants to Central America. They can do that with Mexico. They can't do that with Central American immigrants. And in order to stem this crisis, he's got to get Congress to act on that quickly. And of all weeks to pick, you know, slamming the Republicans, he does it just when he's having a big ask to them.
Margaret, does the White House see a way out of this box? Public opinion of his presidency, Congress not cooperative on many fronts, but needed.
Yeah, I mean, they're playing a defensive game right now. The best way out of their box, if it were possible, and it's getting closer and closer to a Hail Mary with every day, is retaining Democratic control of the Senate. When you say, okay, just sue me, it is certainly a little edgier than I'm going to use the pen and the phone. But it also really reflects, wow, such a cynicism compared with the candidate that you saw in 2008 who says, we got to change, you know, sort of our sarcasm and our mistrust and our cynicism and you know, be optimistic. And I know that ship sailed a long time ago, but can you imagine Obama in 2007 or 2008
No.
going to rallies with, you know, 100,000 people under the arches in St. Louis or something and saying, just sue me?
No,
not
a bit.
It's just such a change.
James, we need to run through a couple of other things abroad with you. Ukraine. Had a ceasefire that's gone now. Putin in Russia again suggesting maybe they get involved militarily seems to be the suggestion. Where are we headed there, James?
Not a good place. There was a meeting this week in Germany that brought the Ukrainians, the Russians, and the Germans and the French together to talk about this. They're trying to, you know, piece together another ceasefire. But, you know, the more bloodshed, I mean, the new president there has launched an offensive to take back the area from these pro-Russian rebels. And the more bloodshed that gets spilled, the less likely a deal will be.
Japan saying it's changing its interpretation of its peace constitution this week. This is history-making to say its military can be more active. This was a major change by Japan after World War II. Now Prime Minister Abe saying they're going to turn that around. What's driving that?
Well, Abe himself is a nationalist. He tried to do this when his first term and before some years back. It's something that we've been pushing Japan to do. With the rise of China and our pivot to Asia, we need strong allies who can be partners in military-to-military engagements. We saw a little bit of that with Japan.
But this is China prompted, we presume.
Sure. Absolutely. It's us trying to build strong alliances in Asia to sort of counterweight against the rapid rise in power of China, what's been accompanied by some pretty tough, claims on islands that are disputed territory in the East and South China Sea. So this is something we've been wanting, but it makes obviously the Chinese very angry, and also the South Koreans, because Japan has never really come to grips with its wartime atrocities in World War II, and so it creates tensions. So in one sense, we like that Abe's doing this; it can be a stronger partner, but he also, couples it by going and visiting war shrines. lines that raise tensions in the region.
Yeah,
so it's a one step forward, one step back kind of thing.
And then this sound out of Hong Kong, my home for several years, sympathy there. People saying, we want more democracy here. And this is aimed at China. Huge crowds in the street. Hong Kong with its, oversight by Beijing, a part of China, but it's supposed to have its own system. And Hong Kongers there saying, let us have a voice in our democracy here. What do you expect from Beijing, James?
Well, they'll be very tough on the rhetoric, but they don't really want to have a huge crackdown now. They have a lot on their plate right now. So I suspect they hope this will pass over. The demonstrations were really about letting the people of Hong Kong decide who their candidates will be to lead them. Right now, that's kind of a handpicked by China and Beijing. So I don't think that they're going to get their way. I don't think the Chinese are going to give on that, but I think that they'll want to sort of let this sort of pass on.
Lots in play this week at home and abroad. We're grateful to all three of you for being with us. James Kitfield with National Journal, Defense One. Thanks very much for joining us today, James.
Thanks, Tom.
Margaret Tolliff, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Thank you for joining us, Margaret.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, great to have you here.
Thank you.
Beyonce, number one on the Forbes list of world's most powerful celebrities this week. Her recent tour show brought in an average of $2.4 million per city. Self-titled fifth studio album, Beyonce broke sales records all over iTunes after no promotion. Big in our world. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us this week. Have a good fourth. This is On Point.